20 years ago, a delegation came to the yeshiva from the State of Israel Attorney General. Thanks to the water, whoever produced it. The government at that time was considering making a law to outlaw cults. And they didn't want the Baal Tshuva movement to be included in the law. Very enlightened. So they came to us for help in framing the law in such a way that the Moonies would be out, and Scientology would be out, and Transcendental Meditation would be out, but the Baal Tshuva movement wouldn't be out. So we had a little discussion with them. And we came to a conclusion how it should be done. In the end, they never wrote the legislation, so didn't come to really to fruition. But I think we all learned something from that discussion, that analysis, and that's what I'm going to share with you tonight. But I want to do it by way of an exercise. I want to start by collecting descriptions of what a cult is. What characteristics do you think of when you think of a cult? What kinds of aspects of an organization make it a cult or like a cult? I think if we go through, make a list of them, and then we go through and analyze them in a certain way, we'll learn something very important. So I'm going to start by asking you for your suggestions. What characteristics of a group, the group, the leader of the group, the followers of the group, the values of the group, the activities of the group, in your mind, are associated with making that group to be a cult or to be like a cult? Okay, so common element, and
they try to expand.
Right, I'm trying to think of a simpler word for proselytize. They try to get members, and you say they get members by promising a reward. Some kind of reward for following the group ways. Right? Okay. What's not, what else?
Ignorance.
What did
it? Most people join them don't know what it really is.
Okay. In other words, the members, or when they join anyway, new members, not informed. Okay. What else?
There's not a lot of contact with outsiders.
Okay. Cut contact with the outside. Good. What else?
They target vulnerable people.
They look for vulnerable people. Okay. Recruiting, that's the word I wanted, instead of proselytizing, right? When they're recruiting. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
It's a goal.
The group is centered around a goal. Okay. Right. What else?
I think it's usually something that a big percentage of the world doesn't agree with.
So it's going to be a minority.
Yeah.
Minority, okay. What else?
Look down upon by anyone else who's not in it.
No, we could have minorities that are respected or treated as equal, no, they're despised, okay? What else?
We
mention isolation?
Yeah, he said cut off from contact with the outside.
Short lasting.
The cult, in other words, it's just short, brief life. Of course, it would be hard to know now, right, how long it's going to last. If I'm looking around, there's groups that are in existence now, and I'm asking which ones are more culty and which ones are less.
Well, I have never heard of a religion suddenly coming to an end, but I've heard of several cults just coming to an end after several people just killed themselves.
And religions do end, right? I mean, all the ancient religions are gone. Ancient Greek religion is gone, ancient Egyptian religion is gone, ancient Persian religion is gone, they're all gone.
How long were they around for, though?
But you're looking at a group today, and you're asking, is this a cult? Is it more like a cult, less like a cult? You don't know when it's going to end. So it's hard to know how long it's going to last. Yeah. So there's an authority structure, and I guess with a small top. Small top, and a big gap to the bottom. A cult, a group that offers sacrifices would be associated with a cult. Okay, sacrifices. What that they use behavior? In other words, they offer rewards for what you do, and
they use rewards, or they try to institute punishments for how they want you to behave.
Okay, reward and punishment to modify behavior. Okay.
Clothing, apparel.
It means some kind of uniform. Okay. Good.
Looking down on others.
Okay. So I say the superiority. They feel they're superior. Left out one category that seems to be fairly important. How about property?
Property?
Yeah.
Well, they usually have these big gates that you can't see through.
Big what?
These big gates that you can't see through.
Oh, no, I don't mean that. I mean, what about the members? Don't they?
I think they're encouraged to give up their, donate all their money and donate all their property to the cult.
And raise money for the cult. Right. Well, we shouldn't say cult, that's begging the question, but to the group, right? Right? Or raise money for the group.
Very strict.
Strict standards. Good, we got about 20. Anything else that...
Not necessarily mono or polytheistic.
Say it again? How's this going?
They don't necessarily believe in one or many gods. Like, is that...
You mean that they do believe in no gods?
No. They all share in common... I don't know. I guess I can't figure it out already. Not that they all believe in one god. They all believe in many gods. They're all... It varies.
You mean the people in the cult have different beliefs about how many gods they believe in? No.
Like-minded
people.
I don't think this can be written down.
Yeah. What was it? Like-minded people. We said it's the common goals and.
Same or indifferent to a deity or not, whether it is or not. It's irrelevant. The same.
Yeah.
There's no concern with religion. No concern with God. And is there unconcerned with God?
No, that's not it.
I mean, they're purely religious cults, right?
I mean, indifference.
Indifference to what?
To whether or not there's a deity.
That means
I have no... This would be something that you don't write down, because it's something they all don't share in common. The amount of God that you don't apply...
I don't think
that
he's in common. Even saying they're agnostic, it's not even part of the issue.
But surely not. I mean, they are religious cults, right?
Yeah.
What about the Reverend Moon? You know,
I'm
mean,
not arguing.
Yeah, and I'm not. I don't see this as a something that I would say. As long as they don't have religious beliefs, that makes them a cult.
No, I'm agreeing.
I mean, yeah, there's something. Yeah, not quite that. Okay, now I want to try an exercise. We have here about 20 different characteristics that people, some people at least, think are associated with being a cult. What I want to ask is this: for each one, can you find perfectly good, valid, legitimate, productive, positive, acceptable, nice, friendly groups that have these characteristics? Again, we're going to go through each characteristic, and I want you to think, are there good groups, nice groups, groups we'd like to support and encourage, that have these characteristics? For example, you should ask each characteristic: would this characteristic apply to the average university, or to a football team, or to an orchestra, or to the army, or to the stock market, or to a baseball team? Or if this characteristic, each one as we go through, applies to perfectly good groups, then associating it with cults will be at best pointless. And if cults have it, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them, because universities have it, and political parties have it, and baseball teams have it, and armies have it, and orchestras have it. And so, you know, if this group has it, certainly doesn't make it bad. But, oh, we left out a whole bunch, actually. But that's the exercise. The exercise is to take each characteristic and ask whether there are perfectly good, acceptable groups that have these characteristics. And if there are, then that characteristic can't be something that's wrong or bad. So associating with cults means that you're sort of whitewashing cults, or you're not getting cult right. Let's say common element. The suggestion was that a cult, the fact that a group of people share a common element, makes it culty, cult-like, you know, something that's suspicious. You know, you want to really beware of them because they all have a common element. Well, how about people who eat macrobiotic foods? They all share a common element. They all have the same diet. Does that make them somehow suspicious? There must be a cult of microbiotic food eaters. How about Dodger fans? Oh, the Dodgers are gone. The Yankee fans, or the Bruins fans. The Bruins fans all root for the Bruins. They all have a common element. Does that mean there's really a cult of Bruins fans? I didn't say Democrats. Maybe there, it's right. But Republicans, right? Republicans all share similar values and similar priorities, similar vision of how the government should work. Does that mean the Republicans are a cult? Common element surely isn't going to help in describing cults if so many of these other groups of people who are perfectly acceptable groups of people have this quality of sharing a common element. So I think we can cross that one out. You try to recruit by promising a reward for following the group ways. Well, how about people who recruit for a macrobiotic diet, or environmentalists who actively recruit members on the grounds that you're saving the planet, and we'll all have a cleaner and healthier environment for ourselves and our children and grandchildren. Or political parties who say, we'll run the economy better, we'll give you better security, we'll increase exports, you know, we'll increase exports, we'll, right, if you vote for us. Aren't they promising a reward if you follow the group ways? Or exercise programs that offer incentives, you know, we'll give you 1 month free if you take a 12-month membership, and you know, and you'll feel better, and your hypertension will go away, and you'll lower your risks of terrible diseases. Aren't they promising a reward if you follow the group ways? So it just sounds like that's so common to groups that are perfectly acceptable, that it's hard to... You look for vulnerable people. What do social workers do? Government-paid social workers. Don't they look for vulnerable people? That's their job. Their job is to find vulnerable people and, as they say, help them. Right? Help them. Get them signed up for the government program and provide them with services because they need help because they're vulnerable. Right?
What advertising companies do the same thing?
Advertising companies do exactly the same thing. They look for people whom they can stimulate a need and they stimulate the need and then tell you how to fulfill it by buying their product. I don't know, maybe with the advertisers, maybe we advertise, we should say it's a cult. But we don't usually talk that way. You know, we don't usually think of them as that kind of a group. Have a common goal. Almost every group has a common goal. Usually it's the common goal that unifies the group. Right? The football team has a common goal. They want to win! Does that make them a cult? The orchestra wants to produce high-quality music. Every group, almost every group, has a common goal, and all these groups are perfectly acceptable. Minority, I mean, when you talk about groups, they're always minorities, right? The majority is never a group, it's the majority. lovers of Baroque music and people who bird watchers are a minority, and that certainly doesn't contribute to their being a cult. If the group is despised, would that make them a cult? Because others despise them? Because others don't like them? Why would it make them a cult? Take those who... I remember hearing an interview with a teenager about 20 years ago. That's when, I mean, I show myself to be out of touch, but that's when heavy metal was really very popular. I don't know if they still do it or they don't. And they asked this kid, what do you see in that noise, music, I'm not sure what word to use. What do you see in it? What attracts you to it? And he says, it's enough for me that I know that my parents hate it. That was a true word. That was a true word. Yeah. But still, would you say that the lovers of heavy metal music, if that's not an oxymoron, those pretend to love it, or those who, you know, are a cult because the parents don't look down on them, because the parents despise them? That makes them into a cult? Because others look down on them and despise them? Why would that make them into a cult? Maybe it makes the people looking down on them a cult, I don't know. Short group life. Anyone who follows fashions has a short group life because fashions last a year or two and then you go on to something else. Authority structure. Small group at the top, and a rigid structure down to the bottom.
Corporation.
A corporation, the army, an orchestra, a football team, I mean, professionals, you know. There's always an authority structure. All these things have authority structures. You can't, well, I don't want to justify, but it's a fact. The truth is that that is very, very common. To make sacrifices, every political party wants your sacrifices. If you mean sacrifices of animals in a religious matter, so all ancient religions had sacrifices, and some today also, like Hinduism and others, practice sacrifices, and we wish we could have our sacrifices back. Surely just wanting sacrifices, practicing sacrifices, isn't going to be enough to qualify as a cult or even contribute to it. Reward and punish behavior. That's everywhere. Someday, I'm glad you're sitting down. This is going to come as a shock. Someday you're going to have to go to work. And if somebody hires you and pays you money, he wants something from you. He's not paying you money because you're good looking. He's paying you money because he wants you to do something for him. And if you do it well, you get more money. And if you do it less well, you get less money. And if you do it too poorly, you'll be fired. That is definitely behavior modification. They are pushing and pulling you, the carrot and the stick, to get you to do something. All of life is like that. Wearing a uniform. So football teams wear uniforms, and marching bands wear uniforms, and even symphony orchestras wear fancy formal nightwear. Judges wear uniforms. Superiority. Let's take Mensa. You know what Mensa is? That's the International Club of Very Bright People. You have to have an IQ of 130, 140 to get in. They have this test of super brain teasers, and you have to solve a certain amount of time to get in. And they definitely think they're superior to other people. Probably they're right. Mentally, anyway, a certain type of intelligence, they're definitely right. They have superior intelligence to other people. Does that mean they're a cult? It's a group of people who are superior in certain ways, and they like each other's company because they share the superiority, and they believe they're superior. I don't think that even pushes them in the direction of thinking that they're a cult. Strict standards for behavior, so does the football team, and so does the orchestra, and certainly so does the army. And I want you to know, many years ago, I read in the paper that the night before the Super Bowl, the owner of one team, or the coach, one of the people responsible for one of the teams, told that team, when you go home tonight, the night before the game, don't have relations with your wives. Because he felt that would affect their ability to play on the following day. Now that means they're telling these people how to live with their lives, their wives. My goodness gracious. Talk about strict standards. Giving property to the group or raising money to the group. There are groups that are struggling to stay honest, to stay alive, and they ask money from their members because they think that the group is worth perpetuating. What is the job of a president of a university? Do you know?
Fundraising.
He's a schnorrer. He's a fundraiser. His job is to raise the millions of dollars that it takes to keep a university going every year. A student to a university, at most, pays one-third of the cost of his education. Two-thirds he gets free. Going to university is a gigantic gift. Where does the money come from? The president goes to people and asks them for $1 million every year. Past people who were there, or people who are interested, or people who have contracts, or who knows what kinds of businesses. Sure, because any group that can't pay its expenses has to raise it by appealing to people. So either you ask the people for sacrifices, or you go outside. Or something like that. Right? Rabbi Schiller always says the proof that Rosh Hashanah is not a cult is that cults, like the Moonies, send the members out to raise money for the leader. And the yeshiva, the leader, goes out soliciting money to support the members. The yeshiva goes all over the world asking for charity so that the students can continue to study without having to worry. Right? This is the exact opposite of what's usually done for a cult. I think that most of what comes to mind when people talk about cults is totally irrelevant. We could have put down changing the values. Changing the values of the members. Changing their priorities. Changing their behavior radically. Cutting off members from their parents and their families by changing their whole world outlook. But the university does that too. And political parties will do that too. In my generation, where the parents were themselves immigrants or children of immigrants, and the great dream was to send their children to college, and the parents were by and large middle of the road to liberal. And then the kids went to college. And of course, the colleges were full of pseudo-intellectual radicals. Left-wing liberals and radicals. And the kids came home and despised their parents. Because the parents were so ignorant. And they, at the age of 19 and 20, suddenly knew the truth, which their premeditated, cynical, hypocritical professors fed to them by way of using them as pawns, as tools in their political intrigues. So the university drove a wedge specifically between the children and the parents. I don't think that made the university into a cult. No, all of this is a mistake. All is a mistake. And the key example, if you want to fight this battle really nasty, the key example that works, a single example that works for all of them together is, and this was in an article in the Haaretz newspaper many years ago, is the early Zionist movement. Let's take the early Zionist movement in Europe. What did they do? They preached to religious kids an entirely new set of values and told them to turn their backs on their parents and family, turn their backs on their schools, turn their backs on the values of the community, to give up their jobs or give up their hopes or give up their plans, to contribute their money and their time and their effort to making Aliyah, if possible to come on Aliyah themselves, to drain swamps in the Galil, the beautiful Hula Valley that Rabbi Geffen waxes lyrical over every time we drive over. You see all the beautiful, with malaria-infested swamps. And they died there. They died there. Kids in their teens, in their 20s, in their 30s, came and drained the swamps and died. All these characteristics that you think of as a cult sharing a common element and having a goal and having a hierarchy of command. There were certain leaders who were very highly respected and they set the tone for everybody else. I don't think anybody wanted to call the early Zionist movement a cult. So this whole approach isn't going to go. I left out a couple that people mentioned, which I think really are right. What we said to the representatives of the Attorney General's office is this. If you're going to talk about the goals of a group, if you're going to talk about the effect on the lives of the members, you're not going to be able to distinguish cults from other perfectly legitimate, valuable groups. What you have to talk about is the method by which they operate. And here are the two elements of method, which really are vicious, should be criminal, and do identify groups as cults. One is fraud, and the other is coercion. Okay, those are big words. I'll explain what they mean. Fraud means you lie about what your group is. This is what somebody said, that non-members are, and the ones who are new members are uninformed. You lie about what your group is, what it stands for, what it's trying to achieve and accomplish. We had a fellow here about 12 years ago, 15 years ago, told us that he was walking on King George Street. You've never been there, I know that. You don't know where, but there's a place called, in the center, you know, about a mile from here, called King George Street. And somebody comes up to him and says, you're an American, yes, how do you like Israel? Well, to tell you the truth, it's pretty pushy, you know, people are pretty rough and they're not very polite. Oh, the other guy says, I see, we share the same feeling about Israeli society. He said, I want you to know, I'm a member of a group, and this group is dedicated to trying to civilize Israelis. I know that sounds like an impossibility. You know, we're trying to make them into kinder, gentler, you know, nicer people. Would you like to come to a meeting? So he said, sounds like a great idea. You know, I'm happy to come to a meeting. And he went to the meeting, and it was the Moody's. He didn't tell him this was a religious group with a leader who claims that he's God or God's right-hand man and that they have to give money all day. It was a completely misleading description of what the group is about. They practice systematic fraud. Some of you have heard of transcendental meditation. Some people think that that's a relaxation technique. It's a way of just relaxing and getting yourself more on balance. And it is at the beginning. But when you get deep enough into it, you burn incense to ask the statues. They just don't tell you that at the beginning. Because if they told you that, you'd have second and third thoughts about joining. So they tell you it's a relaxation technique until they get you in. So that's one thing, fraud. And the other is coercion. Like isolation. Putting people in a situation where for some reason or other, none of the telephones work, and the fax machines don't work, and your cell phones just go dead, and the email machines are all out of whack, and you're out of touch. And the grounds where you are 50 miles from any other I'm going to take you out for a 5-day thing to a fabulous resort in the mountains for 5 days. When you get there, you find out that for 50 miles around, it's just empty land. And there's no public transportation. Only their bus took you there, and that's it. And there are no newspapers, no mail service. You're cut off. This is... where they practice sleep deprivation. They get you up at 2 a.m. and they were for calisthenics, or special lectures, and they run you around the block, and they feed you protein-deficient foods with high sugar, and you know it's impossible for you to really concentrate. They restrict your movements. You can't come and go as you please. Coercion. Fraud and coercion. Those two elements are criminal. They're immoral. There should be legislation against them. And that's what describes groups that you want to stop. Because those two ideas, fraud and coercion, are things that are really immoral to practice and should be stopped. Now, if you look at the Baal Teshuva movement, and in particular Baal Teshuva institutions, the incidence, the practice of fraud and coercion, I would say, is next to zero. I don't know other institutions except by what I've spoken to other people, but I don't think they're that different from what's Sameach. Now, this building is the introductory building. I suppose in theory we could say anything we want in here. You know, we could tell you that the goal of this group is for everyone to maximize the number of hours of television that he watches for the rest of his life. Or to maximize the number of ice cream cones he eats for the rest of his life. Or we could tell you, we could say anything, you know. But there'd be one big problem. Because 50 feet from here is the Beis Medrash. And they're the people that came through here 2 years ago. They're the people who we produce. That's our product. And it's 50 feet from here. And all you do is walk over there and see those people and talk to those people, and you see they're not maximizing television and they're not eating ice cream cones, and you see what they're doing. What we are preaching, what we're selling, what we're producing is open and visible for everyone to see. And when you go to houses for Shabbos, you see the families, you talk to the people, and you can see very well what it is we are in the business of producing. Those are the kinds of lives that we hope people will lead. So there can't be any question of fraud here. In our literature, when we advertise programs, I don't know how many of you came on them, the summer programs, the winter programs, or you participated in them. I think the literature that I have seen in advertising is perfectly accurate. We advertise shura, we advertise traveling, we advertise meeting with personalities, and we provide those things. So the idea of fraud certainly doesn't apply to the way in which an institution like this runs itself. And in terms of coercion, I mean, you all have the opportunity for email accounts, and there are public telephones here, and you can walk off campus at leisure. Yes, in the introductory department, we have a very strict standard of participation, 7 hours a day. That only leaves 17. Okay, let's say you sleep 7, that leaves 10. At least 10 hours a day to yourselves to do as you please. But 7 hours of participation. I wouldn't say that that's too heavy a burden. Of course, if you got used to university days of 2 or 3 hours, it might seem a big burden, but you could probably live up to it. You know, people who work put in 7 hours a day, and they don't regard that as overly coercive. Yeah, you're encouraged to spend a few more, maybe even 9 or 10 hours a day. Still at least 7 hours a day to do as you please. Okay, 2 of them are needed for eating. At least 5 hours a day for recreation, reading, music, go for a walk, go to a museum. It's still certainly not overwhelmingly crushing burden on your time. And you can get a newspaper, you can go to a cafe. There are kosher cafes. You can go to a cafe, you can drink a cup of coffee, you can talk to a friend, you can meet a friend. You can go away for Shabbos. So, I don't see, I don't know if I should comment on the food. But although it probably isn't the most appetizing and most deliciously prepared food, it is nutritionally balanced, I believe. And you can supplement it with whatever you like, with a number of food shops that are within a block or two of here. There's no difficulty. So I don't see any charge of fraud or coercion. Beyond that, if indeed we do have an effect on the lives of our students, so do universities and so do summer camps, and so do political groups whose purpose is to change your values and change your priorities and to make you into people dedicated to a certain goal. So we join the competition with all those other groups, and we instruct and train people in what we believe to be the best that a person can do, just like other groups do. And then there's an open competition of those who have a vision of the way the world works and the best way to live in it. But that doesn't make any of the groups a cult, or at least not in any objectionable sense, nothing that people should be upset about or worried about or try to restrict. The only other claim that I have heard people make, and I will mention it now, and then I'll have maybe 3 or 4 minutes to answer questions. Some people say that the educational system here is overwhelmingly, it's 100% biased in one direction. We only teach the Orthodox point of view. Indeed, some might say only one sector of the Orthodox point of view. Wouldn't it be fairer, more open to teach a broad spectrum of Jewish ideas, including non-Orthodox ideas or non-Haredi ideas? The answer to that argument is as follows. Everyone who comes into this, certainly into the introductory section, everyone who comes into this wing of the yeshiva comes from a non-religious background. That means that essentially reform, reconstructionist, conservative, liberal, humanist type ideas have been part of their lives for 20 years. Orthodox ideas are totally unknown. They have never brushed a sleeve against an Orthodox idea. So we are trying, in a short period of time, to introduce the student to something utterly new. Does it make educational sense when a student has spent 15 years hearing one set of ideas and now has 6 weeks or 6 months to acquaint themselves with a new set of ideas to spend half the time replaying the last 15 years? It just doesn't seem educationally efficient or sound. Why would you do that? It'd be sort of like saying that when you decided in college to learn Italian, half of the Italian class should be spent teaching English. Because it's not fair to English if you're going to spend the whole class teaching Italian. The answer is, I came to this class to learn Italian. I've been speaking English for 20 years. I want to learn a new language. Why should I spend half the time learning the new language on the old language? Here you're getting a first taste of an entirely different system, one about which either you've heard nothing or what you've heard has been premeditated lies, like the New York Times. And you have a short period of time to try to come to grips with a really different, new perspective. I don't see any reason why that should be done. Certainly not for the 6-week summer program or the 3-week winter program. But even the longer period of time to get any depth of grasp. To get any depth of grasp. There's no reason to dilute it. And your helpful, friendly critic who's pleading for more openness, you could point out to him that in none of his institutions is this ever practiced. Never does a budding reform rabbi get access to a real Orthodox teacher. Never does a budding conservative rabbi get access to a real Orthodox teacher. So they don't practice what they preach either, because they know very well that if they had a real Orthodox teacher, their whole program could go to pieces. Because their students never got a brush with traditional Judaism, with authentic Judaism, there'd be serious trouble in the ranks. So they are very careful to make sure their faculty has no representation of the Orthodox point of view. No. So if that's the claim, they don't practice what they preach. Yeah.
About coercion. Isn't the army somewhat coercive in that sense as well? That they cut off access and they restrict movement and they physically also go put you through the ringer, et cetera, et cetera.
It's interesting. There may be cases in which coercion is necessary, but it's not that. I don't claim here to cut off access to the outside world. Every soldier, I'm sure, has times during the day when he can make phone calls. I'm sure they all have email accounts. I'm sure they can all buy newspapers. I'm sure they're not. They can receive visitors. I don't think that they're cut off in that way. Sorry, again? They all have cell phones. I mean, I don't think they're cut off in that way. I don't think it's that serious. Yeah.
Coercion
will
only be coercion if it's preceded by
force,
or else you're going into it knowing what
you're
getting into.
Well, that's a subtle question. Let's think. No, you might go in having been sold a bill of goods that it's good for you, and then later, once you're under it, realize that it isn't good for you. But he has an interesting point. Let's suppose that the yeshiva... not the yeshiva, the cult, whatever it is, right, advertises its menu. You know, pizza and ice cream for breakfast, and soy hamburgers for lunch, and pizza and ice cream for dinner, you know, 6 days a week, and the seventh day a week, it's all cake or something. And the guy says, wow, that's great, I'm going for that. So now, when he's in it, and his mind is destroyed by the fact that he's eating all carbohydrates and sugar, Can you fault the group because they told him what he was getting into? He asks, isn't all coercion necessarily the result of fraud? Even if it were so, it would be an additional element. You could have fraud without coercion and fraud with coercion. So it doesn't follow that it's not an independent element. It's worth mentioning as a separate element because you might have one without the other. But let's see now, could you have coercion without fraud? So I think you have to say, it could be advertised that it was good for you, and then later they could know that it's not good for you? It's only fraud in a subtle sense. In other words, they're telling you what will happen. They're not just telling you what the results are. They're not telling you the optimal results will be opposite. Not that. Maybe that's fraud. Maybe that's fraud.
There's a way to get around having to be fraud. Maybe McDonald's says it's what you want, and no one realizes that it's that 9,900 calories per burger, and now there's people suing McDonald's because they said we didn't realize it was so unhealthy.
See, the question is that fraud or is it not? You just don't tell them. Is that fraud? Fraud, to be prosecuted, has to be where you make a positive statement that's a lie. If you leave out information and people buy your product without that information, unless you have reason to think that had they had the information, they would have bought differently. I said, listen, if you wanted to know, we have a thing, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. The buyer has a responsibility to investigate the product and decide whether he wants it or not. So only in extreme cases like addictions. If a product's likely to be addictive, I was using aspirin with codeine for my infection for a couple of days. On the blurb inside, by the way, they're so clever, the blurb has every possible piece of information required by law. They love this. That's not a burden for them. They love this. Because when the consumer opens up this thing and he sees it, it's 6 pages long, he doesn't read it. So the more information they put in, the less likely it is to be read. They love to put in more information. Because then it means no one will read anything. And it won't hurt their sales at all. That's how the public and the big business work. But in there it says habit form or addictive. And they have to say that because that, everyone knows, will be an important thing. But like he says, number of calories per burger, I think it would be very difficult to sue them and say, you have to put down the number of the calories per burger. Let the person buying the product ask for it, and if he doesn't ask, it means he doesn't care. If he doesn't care, why do I have to offer the information to him?
If the result is what the tobacco company said, they might have to put on the packages, if you eat 1,000 of these in a year, you will die of whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Clogged arteries. And if you bought it, you got a clogged brain. Okay, I got to go.